Hey, Harold Pollock.
Hello, Glenn Lowry. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, good morning, Harold. This is Glenn Lowry at Brown University and BloggingHeads.tv, The Glenn Show. And I'm happy to welcome back my friend, colleague, and frequent conversation partner here, Harold Pollock of the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago. Harold, you are a health policy expert. I think I can say that without any fear of being contradicted. Certainly not
That's
by you,
right. Yes, I will not contradict
but and you and I have talked here back and forth. Me being less informed than you, I'll admit it. But having my prickly side with respect to the Affordable Care Act and whatnot, and you being a dyed-in-the-wool Obamaphile and health guy who thinks this is the greatest thing since sliced
Well, that
bread.
one we can talk
And it
about,
look
but go ahead.
oh, okay. Well, no, of course it has warts, but all in all, a big step forward for U.S. Social policy. We've made it a more perfect union, as the president put it. So I'm very interested, and I saw you had a piece at Politico on this theme to get your reaction to justice. Chief Justice John Roberts' endorsement, in effect, of the arguments that you and other defenders of the Affordable Care Act have been making, that this lawsuit that threatened actually to, derail this major shift in American social policy, that this lawsuit had no merit, and the Supreme Court came down on your side, and that's great. I mean, I'll just say from my own account, I think that's great. What a mess had they done otherwise. But I'm wondering if you could opine about the larger meaning of this
It's such
development.
an interesting thing. There are two major lawsuits about the Affordable Care Act, as many as I'm sure most of our listeners would know. And the NFIB case that was decided in 2012 was really about large issues of constitutional conservatism, the New Deal, the scope of the federal government, and its power to regulate the national health care economy. And I think that that suit, although I certainly think that the ACA deserved to be upheld, and I very much lament what happened to Medicaid as a result of that court decision. That 2012 decision was really about large constitutional issues in American government. And
If I may, I just want our readers to know, I want our viewers to know that that's the case in which the central issue was the constitutionality of the individual mandate that requires by law that Americans purchase health insurance coverage. That was the issue there to which you were referring, the large constitutional question, a legitimate
And
question
also
that was
the
resolved in favor
extent
of the law.
that the federal government can leverage its support for Medicaid to force states to take certain policy decisions in the same way that the highway trust funds, for example, are used to raise the drinking age and things like that. So there are really important issues in the relationship between the states and the federal government in that case. And in contrast, King versus Burwell really was that it was not about large issues. It was about statutory interpretation and how to interpret one awkward sentence in a 2,000-page bill. And when this thing first came along, both Democrats and Republicans basically had a WTF reaction to the whole thing because Democratic and Republican policymakers had always proceeded on the basis that that the government argued in King versus Burwell that everyone was entitled to subsidies, and whether a state chose to do a establish its own health insurance exchange or rely on the federal government would not have any bearing on the ability of citizens to access federal help for to join the health insurance marketplace. And in fact, simulations of the health insurance market demonstrated that you really couldn't, the marketplaces really could not work without those subsidies. And it was a curious case. As it started to find traction among Republican appointed judges, things started to get very politically polarized. And and certainly everyone who favored the ACA was appalled by this, but also many Republican policymakers and certainly state policymakers in places where they had federal exchanges were quite anxious about it and wanted to see this thing go away. And It's a curious case, and I think it was actually preposterous on the legal merits, but I must say that it's probably reminiscent of some of the things that legal entrepreneurs on the left were doing at a time when the court was, was stacked with liberals. That you sort of throw the ball near the basket and you hope that the justices jump up and dunk it for you. And thereby achieving a political outcome that you could not achieve, legislatively. I know Jonathan Adler and Michael Cannon, who were sort of the two people pushing this suit. I think they believe in what's best for the country and what's best for public policy, but they try to use the judicial system in this very instrumental way, and they emphatically lost, in the 6-3 decision, in which John Roberts basically said, look, this is the structure of this law. This is what the law was designed to do. If we just can't, and if we try to interpret the law the way the plaintiffs claim it unambiguously, should be interpreted, the whole thing falls apart. And we just don't believe that Congress set up something that was deliberately so self-defeating. The court could have ruled for the government in a less emphatic way and just said, well, it's ambiguous and a tie goes to the government in interpreting this law. And they didn't do that. They really did give a little bit of a spanking to the plaintiffs. And now, one of the sad things about this case, though, is I think it was a brilliant piece of legal, political guerrilla theater that all the policy wonks, Democratic and Republican, spent months on this thing. It punctured the sense of inevitability that followed the 2012 election that might have led more states to be, to move ahead with various things on the Affordable Care Act. And it just forced us all to, write all sorts of briefs that explained what the Congress was trying to do and what legislators had in mind when they passed it. It really was, I called it in this Politico piece the greatest trolling exercise in the history of American health policy. I think that's part of why the court responded so strongly to this, that there really was something where this was conspicuously weak in a way that was striking.
So the court was invited to enter into this political argument about healthcare policy, mm-hmm. and it declined the invitation, deferring to the legislative branch and not grasping at this straw, which would have allowed, had the decision gone the other way, a knife to be plunged into the heart of the law by the nine justices who sat there and decided a legal case.
Yeah.
I guess you can't blame the advocates on the other side for trying to play the court to as much effect as they, as they might, even though they didn't succeed on this particular occasion. And you point out that this is not a technique unknown to the left of the political spectrum with a different court at a different time.
No, I think that's right. And there's actually a political science literature that suggests that when one side has a strong majority, that there's some evidence that weaker legal cases make it to the Supreme Court. And it's kind of there's a rational set of strategic decisions by legal actors that sort of say it's worth it to push this case, even though it's marginal, because we might prevail. And
now, at the same time, I wonder what you would say. I have this impression that the law is not popular or as popular as one would want a major, architectural redesign of the American welfare state to mm-hmm. be. That there's still enormous resistance, not all of it coming from, dyed-in-the-wool arch right of center ideologues, yeah. Much of it coming from people who are making practical judgments about how effective the law is working, who are chafing at some of the constraints and impositions that the law has enacted. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court is not the place by fiat and with a blunt instrument to resolve these questions. Yeah. But I just wonder how you envision them getting resolved, because they're not going to just evaporate.
No, they certainly are not. I mean, there's a number of problems in ACA, and some of those problems are issues raised by conservatives, and some of those problems are things raised by people on the left. who regret that it didn't go far enough. And of course, the biggest problem in ACA are all of the low-income people in the southeastern United States who are shut out of Medicaid because of the previous Supreme Court decision. Now, we have about 5 million people that are in poverty who can't get health insurance because they live in, you know, deep red America. And I think that there's a couple of things that have to happen. One is we really do need bipartisanship in health policy. You know, the Democrats have to realize this is not 2008, and the Republicans have to realize this isn't 2010. You know, ACA is embedded in the fabric of American policy. It's not going anywhere. And the thing that I find heartening is that Republican governors and the Obama administration are negotiating, and it's not easy for them. In some ways, it's a lot easier for them to do on issues that nobody cares about that are on page D7 of the paper. So, if, you know,
what are they negotiating? Excuse me, Harold. What are they negotiating about the Republican governors? I assume it's the extension of Medicaid in the states where it hasn't been expanded. But what's the issues with which the two parties are taking different positions?
Well, there are the things that are not front page politics, where, you know, the Affordable Care Act provides a lot of money for different kinds of care models to take care of the disabled, for example. And you see Texas, for example, was taking money, health reform money, to try to improve disability services. And this is a totally different conversation about how to make some managed care model work that the ideologues don't pay attention to, you know, compared to what you have to go through in Medicaid. I think on the Medicaid expansion, Republicans and conservative Democrats also have to find some way to distinguish themselves from the Obama administration and saying, we are not just expanding Medicaid and doing the Obamacare thing. We're doing something different. And sometimes it's just a fig leaf over, you know, minor changes. Some of the states that have actually been fighting with the president, it's actually humorous because the things that they want to do, they want to get a special waiver for things that they actually don't need a waiver for, but they just need to be able to say, we fought with the Obama administration and they're allowing us to do managed care and Medicaid, you know, which you can do anyway. But there's also issues like, can we charge people a copayment to go to the emergency room in our Medicaid program? Can we impose a work requirement? Things that liberals and conservatives really disagree on. Some of these issues are going to be tough.
Well, hold on before you go on, because I'm trying to learn here. What is there to disagree on about that? Why shouldn't, I don't have any position here, but why shouldn't a state level policy maker, if they were to judge on the merits that a copay would, I don't know what, I assume it reduces frivolous use of the emergency room or something like that. Why isn't that something that, you know, you could decide differently in Mississippi than you decided in Nebraska, than you decided in Illinois?
Well, the issue is really how much does that, I mean, there's substantive issues. And by the way, if we weren't arguing about the King case, we could actually be having these kinds of substantive conversations in a much more useful
way. Well, we can now because the case is over.
Yeah.
So
well,
let's
I think
go.
One of the questions is how much, when you do that, if you push that far enough, you're really restricting access to health services that people are entitled to under the Medicaid statutes. You know, if you say we have a $100 copay to go to the emergency room, to give an extreme example, you're essentially saying to poor people, you can't use the emergency room. And, you know, there's no such thing as an obviously frivolous visit to the emergency room. When you actually get down into it, many of the issues that are at stake are more murky. And when we put financial incentives on people, we find, yes, it discourages inappropriate use, but it also discourages appropriate use. And
okay,
so
but with respect, Carol,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
You're not addressing my question, which was different states could have different views about the policy matter you just summarized.
Yeah, no.
Why should the federal law dictate to all states to resolve that issue in the same way? I mean, I see your point, but I could also see that others might come to a different
conclusion. I think there should be some variation. And I think the question is really how much and how do we think about, you know, the pushing and shoving that has to take place? You know, where should it's the retail politics of health policy that has to take place. And, you know, there are times when the Obama administration should probably hold firm and say, look, if you want the money from Medicaid, you can't do this. And there are times when they should say, you know what, we don't like it or agree with it, but this is in the realm of reasonable negotiation. It would be better if we had good health services research that would let us understand how some of these issues actually mattered for people's health and well-being. In many cases, we just don't have that health services research track record right now to to make those kinds of judgments. But I've actually always been one of the people that has said, if we can bring Republican governors along and compromise, we should do this. I've actually been very uncompromising in terms of Republicans in Washington, but I've had a very different view about the states because I basically agree with you that Illinois is going to look different from Mississippi. And if we can get poor people health care in Mississippi by negotiating with Republican politicians there, I'm all for it.
Yeah, good. Sounds good. Now, this was not the only case decided by the Supreme Court in this remarkable
Yes.
term. And the big one, I think one would have to say, is the gay marriage decision, in which the court firmly came down on the side of the LGBT advocates
Yes.
to the effect that they have a constitutionally protected right. To be able to pursue their happiness in intimate relationships that would be formalized in within the context of the institution of marriage, and striking down numerous state laws and I think even constitutional provisions that have, and if I'm wrong on that, and you know that to be the case, please correct me, that have affirmed a marriage as an institution between a man and a woman in the traditional way. There's a case, it seems to me, where the court definitely is doing what you feared might have been done in the case of King versus Burwell, the healthcare case, which is to say, taking out of the realm of political negotiation and give and take a fundamental question of social policy and resolving it on a matter of right that they claim with dispute on the other side of the dissent. To be embedded in the Constitution. And I'm just wondering, again, how you'd react to this, not so much the substance of the question about gay marriage as the role of the Supreme Court within the governance of the United States, whether you find any merit in the conservative complaints. Again, not so much about the substance of the question, should gays be treated with respect in the context of marriage, but rather about who gets to decide that.
Well, I mean, by the way, I don't think this is quite comparable to King versus Burwell because really this is about how we treat a discrete, tiny minority of people who are, who are facing systematic discrimination in public policy. So it's, I mean, there's not quite a parallel there, but it's certainly there is a legitimate question. What is the best way to bring about change in this area, and how unilateral should the court be in pushing that process? I mean, this decision, I get the sense that there's an emerging public consensus right now in favor of same-sex marriage, and I think, by the way, Republican politicians were very quietly relieved by both decisions, and they really
Sure.
wanted both these things off the table, which is kind of another
Exactly.
way of just of in the case of same-sex marriage of describing, the world has changed so much that I think people on the court who might have been wary were ready, ready to say, this is, it's time to do this. I mean, in a way, your question, one parallel to your question would have been, is, what is the right time for a Brown versus Board of Education type decision, and how should it be presented to the public? I think both the gay marriage issue and racial segregation issues, really, they were sort of straightforward violations of at least the way I think about the 14th Amendment. But, if the Brown versus Board of Education decision had come down in 1920, what would have happened if it was just so far ahead of where the society was? I mean, as it was, Brown versus Board of Education has, it's not exactly been implemented in the 51 years since, 50, 61 years since.
Yeah, I don't think the country in 1954 was anywhere near where, the consensus on gay themes is now. I think if you look back at the General Social Survey, they ask a question every year about, how do you feel about interracial marriage? Do you think blacks are too pushy? Do you want black neighbors in your neighborhood and so forth? And I don't think those numbers start getting down into civilized territory until after 1970. Yeah. So, and as you know, there was massive resistance to the 54 Supreme mm-hmm. Court decision. I mean, Southern jurisdictions, some of them closed their public schools rather than comply with it. And as you know, much of the reaction through the 1960s and 70s that has led to the massive movement toward the Republican Party and away from the Democrats in the South of the United States can be traced to, you know, public protest and resistance and reaction against the desegregation orders, of which that Supreme Court 54 decision was a major one. But we've been 25 years working that out. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, those are good points. I mean, I must say I was a little uncomfortable with Justice Kennedy's decision in two ways. One is, it is amazing how much everyone in America waits on the somewhat arbitrary reasoning of this one human being. And I'm a firm believer that we should have an 18-year term for the Supreme Court. Just every 2 years we appoint another justice. And his reasoning was, I would have liked to have seen it a little bit more closely grounded in constitutional interpretation and a little bit less in sort of his moral views of the importance of marriage. Although I was simultaneously moved by some of the things that he said and uncomfortable with the way that this one person's substantive moral judgments were so determinative for national public policy.
I must tell you, Harold, it's extremely troubling to me. I've not really said much of what I thought here. I've just asked mm-hmm. questions.
Yes.
But I must say, there's something. I mean, I get it when the right wingers say this is tyranny. I mean, that actually resonates a little bit with me. I mean, just literally, this is imposition by fiat on people who have very strongly held beliefs about something. Of a latter-day wisdom, which some of the proponents were themselves, I take the president as a leading case in point, not, 10 years ago, not even 5 years ago, ambivalent and uncertain and cautious and no, don't move too far too fast about. Now here we go. All of it's taken off the table. Mm-hmm. All of the political activities that express sincerely held, if erroneous, I'd allow that beliefs about this matter are rendered defunct. And as you say, it basically comes down to a single unaccountable person. And to say that that's inconsistent with democracy, that seems almost literally the case. Now, you might say, yes, mm-hmm. rights are often inconsistent yeah. with democracy. We don't do a plebiscite about whether or not you have a right to speech and you have a right to privacy and so forth and so on. I get that, mm-hmm. but still.
Well, I think there's a tension there. And I think ultimately what should decide this case, we were all staring in the face for a long time, although many of us, were more wary, certainly any elected politician was more wary about talking about this, was that many of these laws are obviously based on both contested religious understandings of marriage and also animus towards people who are partnered with, someone of the same sex. And much as I respect that people have sincere views that are different, the reality is that there were millions of Americans who were being concretely mistreated and marginalized because of laws that really couldn't bear, were fundamentally unjust in a way that did need to be overturned by the court at some point. And I don't think this will prove to be a controversial decision in 5 or 10 years. I think that it, in fact, is following an emerging public consensus in a way that, will be quite different, for example, from Roe v. Wade. I think Roe v. Wade really, is deeply contested in a way that this is not.
Go ahead. We're going to have to see about that. Mm-hmm. I don't have a crystal ball about what will happen. Mm-hmm. And I do agree about the consensus. Mm-hmm. But what I'm not sure I agree about is the certainty with which you pronounce that these matters. And here's how I want to frame it. Not about the opportunity to marry, but rather about the dignity and worth of your way of life. Okay? Now, that's the matter, it seems to me, that's just beneath the surface here. There's no law that says your way of life is dignified or not. Mm-hmm. Marriage becomes the site at which a kind of symbolic struggle about the dignity and worth of a way of life is being played out. Now, taboos around sexuality, which don't have to but often have a religious basis, are nothing new, just as views about race, which don't have to but often have a religious basis. I'm talking about what we would say today are reactionary views. Had been around for a long time. But I think the analogy isn't perfect. I mean, I get it. I get the analogy as a legal formalism, but I think as a cultural commentary, the analogy isn't perfect. I don't think the institution of slavery and then the bequeathing to tens of millions of people of a second-class status within the democracy is equivalent to. It's analogous in certain ways, has certain formal similarities, but in no way do I see it as equivalent to the social taboo and stigma that might attach to certain ways of having sexual intimacy.
There was a social taboo and stigma, and certainly, you know, and churches can continue to not recognize same-sex marriages and so on. But there was also a legal structure where you know, gay people, you know, it was, you know, Bowers v. Hartwick was basically a straight statement that it's okay to ban sodomy because for thousands of years and in our biblical texts this behavior is condemned. And, you know, it is, there is a history of legal mistreatment that is more than just
I'm not talking taboo. I'm not talking about the law. The taboo result in a legal restraint and statute like the prohibition against sodomy coming out of the taboo, which definitely did impinge upon individual liberties and which was ultimately stricken by the court. I'm not now talking about the law. I'm talking about whether or not the word bigot, just to be explicit, whether or not the word bigot is with equal appropriate.
Well, see, I think that you're
let me finish, Harold. Hold on a minute. Okay. Hold on a minute, Harold. I get to finish a sentence. Okay. The sentence was going to end with, and I think you knew what it was going to end with, but I want everybody to hear it, whether or not the contempt or disgust with which a person might react to the idea of men having anal sex is equivalent to and should be regarded in the same voice as a contempt or disgust that a person might have seeing someone black walking down the street. And I want to carve out some space for individuals to be able to legitimately have different reactions to that kind of a personal practice. I mean, to say I don't want my son to be that, is that really an act of bigotry on the part of a father who hopes that his son would have a heterosexual lifestyle? Is it really an act of bigotry to make that judgment? Thanks for letting me finish, Harold.
Well, I think you're running together two issues. I think that we can respect that people have reasons to disagree with the Supreme Court decision and still believe that the decision was right and that these people should lose in the legal and political marketplace. I mean, I think that it is important to respect the dignity of different perspectives on this issue. Even as we fight this out for the equal rights for LGBT people. And you know, if someone feels contempt towards same-sex relationships, there may be lots of reasons why they feel that, but they should not be allowed to use the instruments of public policy to bring that, to pursue that contempt. And there are many people in the Jewish community who have contempt towards intermarriage, and Jewish newspapers, you know, will not run wedding announcements sometimes when people intermarry. I don't think that we would want to see that given public policy weight within a constitutional democracy. And
okay, let me try this. So Stephen Carter, you know Stephen Carter, the lawyer at Yale, and his book of 20 years ago, The Culture of Disbelief, which made a big splash. Mm-hmm. And in there, he talks about the religion, politics, mm-hmm. nexus, and all the mm-hmm. complexity of it. And he did so at a time when the moral majority and the Christian right were more powerful than they are now. And he had a formulation that I thought was brilliant and deeply revealing and just spot on, which was this. He says, those of us who defend the pro-choice position in the abortion debate have to be prepared to affirm that a woman has a right to terminate that pregnancy, even if we acknowledge that the fetus whose existence is being extirpated by her act is a human person. He said, the debate about the humanity of the human status of the fetus is a red herring. Obviously, it's life of a sort. And we could go to our grave splitting hairs about whether or not we want to call it a human being. But the claim that we're making here is that the woman's right to autonomy trumps the fetus's right to life. And we need to be explicit about that claim. And it seems to me that you're saying something similar to that, and I elicit your reaction. That is to say, whatever a person may think in their heart of hearts about how it is appropriate for men and women to lie together, and even though some may find it an abomination, they take that word right out of the scripture, that men would lie with men and women would lie with women. Even so, we have among us today men who would lie with men and women who would lie with women. And to act on your disgust at the way in which they lay one with another would be to impose upon them illegitimately an infringement of their liberty. But they have absolutely as much right as anybody else to have the views that they have about what constitutes an abomination in terms of sexual relations. That, it seems to me, is the position that ultimately is required by what you've been saying.
Well, let me react in a couple of ways for that, and then we should probably move on because I don't have any.
Yeah, let's move on. Let me
just respond. First of all, I think abortion is a uniquely difficult case because one could be a liberal on either side of that issue. And I mean, there are people who, the fetus has concrete interests which are being harmed when someone has an abortion, and a woman has a concrete interest in her autonomy and her right to control her own body. And those two, that is a very difficult issue. I come down in a pro-choice direction for a variety of reasons that we don't have to rehearse now. Abortion is, there really is a question of how do we weigh the interests of the fetus and the interests of a pregnant woman, in public policy. I don't think that same-sex marriage is a good analogy to abortion because it's not that I feel revulsion about abortion. It's that there is a fetus that is being harmed in an abortion, and the concrete harms that one tries to come up with when debating the issue of same-sex marriage, become much more elusive. And in fact, this social science database about children's well-being and so on, turns out to be much more favorable towards same-sex marriage than many opponents, would have predicted. So I just think those two issues are different.
Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want you to address my concern, which is, if I stand up in front of a class at Brown University and say that I think a man lying with a man or a woman lying with a woman is an abomination, unnatural to the ways of God, mm-hmm. I'll be ridden out of town on a rail, Harold. If I'm a business executive and I take the position that I abhor what the Supreme Court has done, and I think the institution of marriage is in grave jeopardy, an institution which is a sacrament of my church and which I blah, 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 mm-hmm. I could lose my job. I could be boycotted. I could be the subject of extreme social opprobrium. And that's, marriage is one thing and the law is the law. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I'm saying culture, change, acceptable attitude, and the way in which we police and restrict what it is that is or is not appropriate to say, we are driving underground I'm talking now about the organized efforts to discredit, marginalize, and bankrupt people who use their right of free speech to express an opinion about the moral status of homosexuality. Okay, and I'm saying that that's not resolvable by the Supreme Court, and it still seems to me to be in flux.
By the way, there's an irony here that LGBT people have for generations and generations been the subject of extreme cultural marginalization. And, when I think about, say, the Bowers versus Hartwick case, that case comes out at the moment that hundreds of thousands of gay men are dying of AIDS, and where the president of the United States essentially will not utter the word AIDS, and where young people are driven to suicide because of the cruel treatment that they are receiving by the great, great majority of their fellow citizens. And
prominent conservative religious leaders are saying that the plague of AIDS is a visitation upon the homosexuals of God's punishment for their immoral acts.
And that is the world that you and I grew up in. And I mean, I certainly remember in my own upbringing, in a Boy Scout camp a visibly effeminate boy being bullied by other boys, with the adults basically saying it's up to him to figure out how to take care of himself. And the opprobrium that social conservatives are now facing as a minority, as a cultural minority, is a real thing, but it is also so minor in comparison. And what the real injury and grievance that people seem to be expressing is that they can no longer with social impunity, express these kinds of views. I don't think that you should be driven out of Brown University if you got up in a lecture and said you believe homosexuality is wrong. I do think that if you're not invited to the next party by your colleague because of that, that it might be your colleague should be a little bit more open-minded, but it might be that he's expressing a social judgment that's part of the life that we all live, where we decide, do I admire this person's values if they are openly criticizing gay people? And if the answer is no, maybe I don't invite them to my party. And I saw this hilarious video that was modeled on the It Gets Better campaign, in which young people were saying, I have this secret, and this person was very emotional. And it turns out she believes that marriage should be between a man and a woman. And there's this sense of, it seemed so ludicrous to present these as mirror images of each other.
I see the irony. I do. And I want to just be clear here for anybody who's just tuning into the Glenn Show that I don't think homosexuality is an abomination. I have a son who is himself a gay man. And if he should hear this conversation, I wouldn't want him to think.
I think he would verbally probably kick your butt in this conversation because he's more eloquent than I am on this point.
We have this argument all the time, in which the black analogy, and I try to point out, I say, man, I get the tactical genius of the black analogy. I just don't think it holds up to any really careful historical or cultural scrutiny. And he says, Dad, please get out of the way. We're making change here.
So shall we get on to the black thing? Since I should tell you, I get a lot of junk mail that presumes that I am an African-American man, given where I live and the causes that I contribute to. So I feel like
let's talk about race, but I want to segue. Okay. I want to segue because I see another analogy that may or may not be right, and that has to do with the Confederate flag, which is coming down everywhere. Yep. I just read a piece in the New York Times this morning reporting on whites who like the Confederate flag and how they're feeling very, shall we say, marginalized these days.
Yeah, it's a sad thing.
Exactly. How much sympathy can we have for people whose dear symbol of Southern way of life and, rebellious independence of their region is being stripped away from them by these descendants of slaves, when in fact that symbol had flown over, the armies fighting in defense of slavery and had been embraced by the governments who refused to extend to the descendants of the slaves an equal citizenship. So that was real harm, akin to what you were saying about HIV and all of that. That was real injury versus the kind of symbolic industry of injury of having your symbol stripped away from you. On the other hand, I want to say this, and maybe it applies a little bit to the victors in the gay rights battle as well. Can't we be a little bit more generous once we've won?
I think it would be wise.
When I say generous, I mean, here's a guy with a Confederate flag painted on the top of his vehicle. Mm-hmm. Okay? He went to school at Alabama, Crimson Tide, whatever, yeah. Okay? He grew up in a small town in Tuscaloosa or somewhere like that, okay? And he's a good old boy. Yeah. Okay? He does what good old boy do. He likes his hunting. He keeps his hounds. Okay? I'm not a good old boy, so I don't know all of what they do. But the Confederate flag, part of that, okay? Mm-hmm. And now he's a bigot. Now he's a racist. Now he's he's this horrible character yeah. because he embraces the symbol. Okay, he sheds the symbol. He can't buy it at Walmart anymore. He repaints his car because he doesn't want people pointing at him. He takes his license plate holder and he, whatever, whatever. But in his heart, he still identifies with this idea about the South. And I'm just saying, man, we won, okay? Did you see the national mourning attendant to the burial of those poor people who were massacred by that nut in that Charleston church? We have won on every front. Isn't it possible to be a little bit generous? And I say this to my son about the gay rights thing all the time. Don't call my church friends. I used to go to church more than I do now, but they are good people. They believe the Bible more literally perhaps than they should, but they're not bad people. Don't call them bigots. Don't talk about them as if they were, you know, the devil's handmaiden. You're winning. Can't you be a little bit generous? So I don't know what you think about
that. Well, I don't believe in I don't believe in calling people bigots. And in fact, one of the great things about doing the intellectual disability work that I do is that, you know, there are people who are pro-life, for example, who would do terrific work in that arena. And people, yeah, I think that making judgments about people's character is always a fraught exercise and an oversimplifying and flattening exercise if you do it on the basis of political symbols. Now, I think that African Americans have a right to not have the Confederate flag flying at the state capitol and being
sure.
And I mean, it's a
if they object to it, if it's hurtful to them and they're citizens of the state. They're 30%, 40% of the state, sure.
And I mean, these are symbols, of course, that came up in the early 60s in many of these states
Indeed, that's a good point.
You know, it's not, somehow, there was a long period where Southern Heritage didn't include these flags. These flags were specifically put up as part of resistance to integration, and they belong to, they should be taken down. I must say, by the way, this is the problem that, you know, I have people that I'm connected to on Facebook who, you know, put up things on Facebook. You know, why are they, you know, I like the Duke of Hazzards, and now, you know, the Dukes of Hazzard. Now they've taken it off, and these are just old boys. And, you know, I don't want to call somebody a bigot because they go to NASCAR and stuff like that. I think we should judge people by how they live their lives as people. And it is probably, you know, in victory magnanimity, as Winston Churchill would say. I must say that I'm more concerned about the ways that we're shutting people out of Medicaid and making it harder for people to vote in a lot of these states. And there's a racial tinge to a lot of these policies there. You know, that's where I tend to get snippy.
Yeah, well, I don't think you and I agree entirely about that. I mean, I don't endorse the stricter requirements of voter registration. And I see the political incidence of imposing those requirements in that it suppresses the Democratic or left of center vote. I don't see it at all as a racial matter. Asking someone to present an ID is not a racial matter, even if the incidence of the effect of having so asked were disproportionately negative on people of a particular race. Nor do I think it's a federal matter, although, and here I would be agreeing with John Roberts and company in their most recent decision about the Voting Rights Act. I mean, 1960, 1950 was a long time ago. I don't think we should be singling out these jurisdictions for special scrutiny and so forth and so on. I think states basically are responsible for deciding how many days of early voting you have and, you know, how far from the average voter is a polling place and what hours do they open and what kind of identification requirements are sustained. So I think to a certain degree, and I'll conclude, Harold, that this you know, attack on Black voting rights is overblown. I understand what a literacy test is. Asking somebody to show a driver's license or a state-issued ID is not a literacy test.
These laws, there's a lot. We could have a whole show on this, which we shouldn't now, but many of these laws are bundled. Many of the ID laws tend to be conspicuously bundled with things that outlaw Sunday voting, for example, when there's no issue of voter integrity. They don't address absentee ballots, which are much more fraudulent than in-person voting. And they're all being pushed by large Republican legislative majorities in purple states. And, you know, the places where there's strategic advantage to minimizing it is partisanship as opposed to racism in its intent. But there's a reason why the Black voters tend to be Democrats and the white voters tend to be Republicans in a lot of these places too. So it's a little hard to You can say, well, they're only just trying to be sleazy and preventing their counterparts from voting. That's not a great
Well,
place to.
look, Harold, if I have any provision about voting that has a racially or ideologically disparate incidence in how it would be provided, that is to say, if I could calculate from statistics that Sunday voting or an extended period of early voting or a certain kind of rules governing absentee balloting will disproportionately benefit or harm the left or the right of the spectrum, then everybody who's involved in that debate is in exactly the same position of arguing over the law with the intent to foster their own partisan advantage. There's no difference, what I'm saying, between the Republicans and purple states who want to, quote, suppress the black vote, close quote, by having people show up and present an ID, which anybody can do if they expend the cost of getting the ID. There's no difference between the position of the Republican who wants to, quote, suppress the black vote and the Democrat who wants to promote the black vote. Both of them are partisans arguing over rules, neutral on their face, with a calculation about what the incidence of that rule change would
Well,
be.
they're both individual partisans trying to advance their own perspective. But in one case, someone is trying to do that by helping their own supporters exercise a lawful franchise. And in the other case, it's someone who's attempting to seek partisan advantage by hindering someone else's efforts to vote. And we just know as just the reality of, the everyday life of a lot of low-income people, that these small barriers, which yes, people should be able to surmount individually, that many of them will not do so. And it is dishonorable, in my view, to pursue those sorts of tactics. There are other things that are, I
I'm
think that
saying,
we,
but
let me
you,
just finish. I mean, I do agree
yeah,
with you
sure.
that there are some of these issues that are definitely bipartisan. For example, the redistricting issue should be taken out of the hands of incumbent politicians. And we need a mechanism that allows for a more legitimate way to design congressional districts. And that's really not a specifically, race conservative issue. But it is dishonorable to basically look at the Obama 08 mobilization effort and say, we have a momentary political advantage. Let's make it hard for people to go to church and then go vote. That to me is, it's interfering with people's efforts to express their political preferences in the political process. And the fact that, yeah, people should go and get an ID and figure out a way to get around all these requirements, yeah, but that's still missing. There's a sleaziness to that, which is, which deserves to be
No,
condemned.
I don't agree with you, Harold, about this, and you're right, this is fit for a longer discussion. What I'm saying is partisanship. I don't get to call one side of a partisan divide sleazy and the other side not because they're the other side.
Well, that's
Okay?
not what I said. I
So
said trying to restrict the voting is sleazy.
they're not trying to restrict the rules apply uniformly to everyone. They have a differential incidence. So how many days of early voting should there be? If I could show you that I get relatively more black turnout if I extended the number of days of early voting by one, that becomes an argument for extending. Or if I objected to the extension and you suspected that my reason for objecting to having early voting 5 weeks instead of four before the election is that I thought it would suppress a black turnout, then I'm a sleaze? Why isn't this simply you and I are fighting over how we're going to design the electoral rules, both of us mindful of the partisan implications of how we resolve it and taking our positions based on our partisan
Well,
convictions. Nobody's a sleaze here. No one's denying anybody the right to vote. We're making the rules about voting.
if you looked at the, for example, the really long lines in Florida in the 2012 election, where African American precincts didn't have, enough capacity to vote, and people had to wait for many hours to vote, that was clearly a deliberate effort to make it harder for people to vote. And it is, I would commend to you the articles, Ari Berman has done a lot of work in The Nation where he's really covered this on a national basis. It seems to me that the facts on the ground are asymmetric in that way. And if Democrats went and made it hard for rural white people to vote to seek strategic advantage, that would also be sleazy. But I think that
Okay.
so let's so maybe we should leave it at that.
Yeah, we can leave it at that. We can leave it at that
Uh-oh, I don't
on
think you're going to leave
behalf
it to
of. No, I'm going to leave the voting thing at
Okay.
that. We will come back to this. This isn't our last conversation. But I did want to express my displeasure with a certain trend and the race-related discourse that we're having in the United States these days in the aftermath of Ferguson, Black Lives Matter, and all of that. And let me just get cut right to the chase. Okay, I'm gonna use the Bill Cosby bomb here. Okay, so recent revelations from some court proceeding somewhere that had been sealed that Cosby acknowledged that he had acquired Quaaludes as a sedative because he wanted to give it to women that he wanted to have sex with, and you know. It was therefore an instrument in his raping of those women, I think we could say without abusive language. Yeah. And I saw Michael Eric Dyson, the prominent intellectual professor at Georgetown University and a writer and commentator on racial affairs, on the Bill Maher show on Friday. He was one of the guests on the panel there. What Dyson said about Cosby was that, see, Cosby's a sleaze and a rapist, a serial rapist, scores of women who have been assaulted, evidently. And think about it, because he's a hypocrite, too, because Cosby, back in the day, was arguing that some of the cultural traits of African-American low-income communities, you know, the family organization, parents not attending to their kids, the norms and values that seem to be manifest by adolescent peer groups and so forth, were dysfunctional. Cosby gave a famous speech at the 50th anniversary of the Brown decision celebration in Washington, D.C., the so-called pound cake speech, in which he came out and excoriated the irresponsibility that he thought characteristic of lower class black culture and so forth and so on. And I'm saying all of that to say the following. It seems to me that a consensus is emerging, not so much about Cosby, he exemplifies this, that any talk about black on black crime in the context of policing and violence. Okay, so how many blacks are being Black Lives Matter? Well, if Black Lives Matter, then why don't we know the names of the poor kids who are being shut down in Chicago and other places by other black people? Yeah. About fatherlessness. If we've got disorder in Baltimore and other such places all of that, part of the reason a person might argue is that the family structure in the black community has collapsed. Well, that is now an unacceptably reactionary position in many quarters, and a person who begins to talk in that way is discounted and not taken seriously. That the idea that while the civil rights movement about legal rights is one thing, the cultural reformations that need to happen in the lower classes of the African-American community is an independent, distinct concern to which one needs to address himself. And that idea seems to be being driven from the stage of legitimate discourse, and this, as I say, seizing upon Cosby's malfeasance and criminality. Again, he has to have his day in court. He hasn't. But apparent is being, I think, taken as an effort to kind of push off of the stage of legitimate discussion any reference to the problems within, the enemy within, I used to call it back in the day when I was writing essays about this kind of stuff. The African-American community, where only people on the ground who have intimate connections with and who have credibility with and who are prepared to directly address these. And I'll conclude, Harold, and I want to hear you. President Obama has been praised for the wonderful speech that he gave at the eulogy of Pastor Clemente Pinckney in Charleston, South Carolina. And part of that praise on the op-ed page of the New York Times and elsewhere has contrasted that speech with others that he's given about race, where whether it's a commencement at Morehouse College or an NAACP, where he has said, yes, there's racism and we will fight it tooth and nail, but there are also issues within the black community. You want to be a father, then stand up and be a father, raise your children, and blah, blah, blah. Obama's previous speeches have now been, I think, in certain quarters, regarded as, you know, less than what we'd have expected from a black president in contrast to the favorable viewing of this most recent speech. And I want to say, for my own account, that I think both can be true. I think Obama can correctly call the nation's attention to the unresolved issues of race that challenge us as a country, and use his bully pulpit to encourage upon African Americans a deep and sustained engagement with reformations that have to occur within our community that only we can affect. And yet I feel this latter position is slipping and losing losing credibility, not only amongst Blacks, mm-hmm. but in the nation more broadly. Thanks for letting me get that said.
No, well, that's, I mean, I liked both of Obama's speechifying experiences. And by the way, Chris Christie referred to the, he said, we have this stammering professor in the White House, I think. That may not, I may have slightly gotten the thing wrong, which is just such a hilarious thing right after.
He ain't, the brother is not stammering, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, it's just sort of to criticize someone on the basis of something that's so patently just, is no face validity is kind of funny. But I think a lot depends on who you're talking to in these speeches. I think when there's a perception that you're speaking to white audiences about Black pathology, you're going to get a totally different reaction in the African American community than when you're speaking to Black audiences. And when, I mean, if you listen to a sermon that Al Sharpton delivers in a church, I think a lot of people who think of Al Sharpton in some sort of cardboard terms would be very surprised to find out how much of it is something that you know, any social conservative would be quite comfortable with. And you know, I mean, he was in Ferguson telling people, you know, don't loot, don't be a thug. You know, this is behave in a dignified way, and you are in front of a cloud of witnesses right now with all this press attention, and don't and you know, you have to behave accordingly. I think when the president of the United States is giving a strategic political speech and emphasizing the lack of fatherlessness, the lack of fathers in the African American community, it's a more complicated speech act that's being undertaken. And I think that that's, people are, there's a discomfort with the idea that he is having a sister soldier moment in this Black church speaking to white people. That is sort of the part of what's going on in people's reaction to his, you know, Father's Day reflections and so on.
Well, so yeah, the way one, I'm sorry, Hilda, I don't want to interrupt you.
I just think that, that is, I mean, there's no, I mean, any, you just walk into any church in Chicago on Sunday morning and you will certainly hear any, you know, you will certainly hear a lot of discussion, a lot of anger about violence, about fatherlessness, about, you know, any, you know, all of the need to address these cultural issues, which I think do think are real, and you know, need to be, you know, African Americans are not the only people who have to be reminded from time to time, as you once put it, of certain elemental realities. But I certainly think it's appropriate when it's an internal conversation; it's going to be seen differently.
Let me say a couple of things. First of all, nothing you can tell me about Al Sharpton is going to make me forget Al Sharpton of old, mm-hmm. and so forth. So, you know, he gave that speech this time. He gave a different speech in previous occasions. Al Sharpton is a chameleon who adapts to whatever. And I ain't no Al Sharpton fan, so I'm on the record.
Okay.
What I want to say about this other thing, though, is the way the writer in the New York Times put it, as she extolled Obama's Charleston speech, even while criticizing previous speeches that he's given about race, which were more demanding of African Americans, is he's finally speaking for us rather than talking to us. He's talking for us rather than talking to mm-hmm. us. And I thought, well, he's president of the United States, all right? So, yes, he will speak for African Americans. He's the first African American president. He almost perforce will be doing that in many ways. And when race-sensitive issues come up, yes, to the extent that he takes a position popular in the community, one can understand him to be speaking for us. But he's president of the United States. Why shouldn't he also speak to us, especially when the things that he might have to say carry great force being said by him and can't be said by anybody else other than an African-American occupying that position? And moreover, doesn't his capacity to act for us depend upon the sway that he has with the entirety of the population, which might be enhanced by speaking to us as well as by saying what it is that we would have him say? That is, for example, with respect to questions of law, order, and justice and so forth, doesn't the president, a Black president, have to stand for law, order, and justice against the mob, et cetera? I know he does. I know he did. But doesn't he have to forcefully do so? And might that not require him to say things and do things that would not fit right on top of the social movement of Black Lives Matter and so on, because he's saying we sent guys out to Ferguson, Missouri to figure out what happened. Darren Wilson actually, according to our best effort to determine what happened, acted appropriately. Stop saying that he didn't. What's wrong with the president saying something like that? Doesn't he enhance his capacity to act on behalf of progressive interests to the extent that he does so? Thanks for listening again.
I thought Eric Holder comported himself very well with the combination of reports about Ferguson, which both spoke to the systematic mistreatment of African Americans and the events in that particular case. It's not exactly clear to me that Darren Wilson behaved appropriately, but it's certainly true that there was a rush to judgment about the, especially the initial confrontation between the two men that,
Hands up, don't shoot. Hands up, don't shoot.
Yeah, there was a petition going around the university, going around my school about that, and I was one of the very few people who did not sign it because I was, I was not comfortable with the description of that particular incident.
If Hillary Clinton says all lives matter, then there's 10,000 words in the various organs of liberal opinion excoriating her for saying all lives matter.
Yeah, no, I don't agree with that. I do think if you're going to speak about crime in the African American community, you know, black on black crime or whatever, there is one thing that I would say. You actually have something. You have to actually have something to say about it, and I think that a lot is sort of the what about black on black crime stuff that you often hear from people comes from such a social distance and a lack of awareness that this is a primeval issue within most African American communities. It is talked about constantly. There are thousands of people who are trying to address the problem within African American communities. And the need to tell African Americans, you know, you need to get your house in order, and you need to realize that a lot of your sons are shooting each other. It's like, no kidding. There's an insulting frame to some of that conversation, which, I want to say, you know, let's talk about black on black crime. What do you have to say about it? What do you, you know, what's your practical suggestion to the people that are out there every day and who have to walk home from the bus every day? I mean, somehow there's this idea that African Americans don't notice that they're scared to come home from work after, you know, in a lot of the places in which they live.
I think the point would be, Harold, that and Heather McDonald was on the Glenn show just a couple of episodes ago talking about these matters. And I had a similar reaction to her as you've just expressed, which is, you know, this is not some abstract thing to the people who are living in these communities. It's not as if there's no there. There's there, and people are definitely engaged with this. Yeah. They're burying people on the street, you know, who are laying dead in the street, et cetera, et cetera. But I think the point would be the police are the main agents of social organization present on the ground in these places, main agents of civic organization, present on the ground in these places. They're not your enemy. Yeah. There are rogue police and they need to be dealt with, but the police are not the enemy here. The police are part of the solution, not part of the problem. If you really believe Black Lives Matter, credit that. The vast majority of police officers think so too, and they're putting their butts on the line in trying to protect Black lives. I think that would be the point.
I guess I would.
That would be one thing to say.
I guess I would
say. That would be one thing to say.
Fair enough. I guess I would say police are both part of the problem and part of the solution at the same time, and that's what makes it so difficult. Because they're so essential. On the other hand, a lot of what the police are doing both undermines their own legitimacy and imposes heavy costs on some of these communities. And so we have to have a way of, and we expect the police to address these very deeply rooted problems that are well beyond their capacity. I mean, it seems to me that one of the real grievances that I hear a lot is, you know, there are people, you know, I live in this neighborhood of Englewood in Chicago. We had the foreclosure crisis. There was no effective response. We have all of these young people looking for jobs. There's no effective response. We have all these educational issues, no effective response. Boy, when the young men are selling drugs in this community, you know, you're on it, you know, and
I hear you. And Harold, forgive me. I got to cut you short, man, because I'm up against it. I got to get to this next appointment in 10 minutes.
Gotcha.
So thanks very much. Good conversation. We'll talk again soon.
Exactly. Bye-bye, Glenn. Always great to talk to you.
Bye-bye. Forgive me being so abrupt, but I have no choice.
It's good. Here. We left it all on the court. Talk to you later.
Okay.